bringing you the truth behind the news. Welcome to The New American.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Dragoo. Right-wing populism is rising in Portugal, and it turns out the Irish still have some fight in them, illustrated by their recent refusal to bow to the woke left. Also, a small group of people are suing the National Park Service for its anti-cash policies. And John Birch Society Regional Coordinator Rhonda Miller joins us to discuss the latest anti-con-con victory, this one in Indiana. We have all that coming up. But first, Peter Navarro, a former economic advisor to President Donald Trump, has been ordered to report to prison on March 19th. Navarro received a four-month sentence for refusing to comply with a Banana Republic-style investigation into the January 6th melee at the Capitol. He was convicted last year on two counts of contempt of Congress for refusing to provide documents and testimony to the statist hacks in the circus that was the J6 committee. The committee subpoenaed Navarro in February 2022, and he responded by citing executive privilege and telling them to go pound sand. The House then held Navarro in contempt 2 months later, and the Department of Injustice soon followed suit with criminal charges. Now Navarro's lawyers are trying to have the sentence stayed while they appeal the conviction. If that doesn't work, he'll become the first key Trump advisor to do time, all as a result of an event that almost certainly wouldn't have turned out violent without the hundreds of FBI agents embedded in the crowd. Navarro says the situation is nothing more than part of the larger coordinated lawfare campaign to destroy Trump and the MAGA movement as a whole. He spoke at last month's CPAC event in Washington, D.C. Here's part of what he said.
In my case, a Democrat House majority held me in contempt on an overwhelmingly partisan vote. A Democrat-controlled Department of Justice indicted and prosecuted me. A heavily skewed Democrat jury right here in the District of Columbia, featuring members who had expressed anti-Trump sentiments in voir dire, convicted me. By the time my case got to the jury, the judge had stripped me of every possible defense, thereby making my conviction a foregone conclusion. As my attorney said, that can't be the law, but it was in that court. The parallels between my own and Trump's case are indeed striking. I am the first senior White House advisor ever convicted of contempt of Congress. Trump is the first former president ever to be criminally indicted. I was put in leg irons by armed FBI agents who far more easily could have asked for my voluntary surrender. Trump was the target of an equally unnecessary armed FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago. I was indicted by the Biden-Garland Department of Justice despite a more than 50-year policy against compelled congressional testimony by senior White House officials like me. DOJ's hypocrite prosecutors would falsely argue to my jury that I had acted above the law when they knew damn well I was simply honoring the Constitution, fulfilling my oath of office, and obeying the law the Department of Justice's own Office of Legal Counsel had long articulated and supported. They want this presidential titan, and I was there when he was that titan, and providential titan who kept our nation in prosperity and out of war for four beautiful years. They want him to die cruelly in prison.
Joining me to discuss today's stories is TNA Executive Senior Editor Steve Bonta. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
Well, all things considering, we're following this closely. I'm obviously very curious to see if someone like Navarro ends up in prison, because what does that say about us then?
Well, again, as we've been saying for months, that we are descending in rapidly, precipitously into banana republicdom. And I mean, you know, and it says something about the double standard too, as we were discussing before we went on air. There have been numerous high officials cited for contempt of Congress, including two, Eric Holder and Lois Lerner, in the latter years of the Obama administration. They never were subject to this sort of zealous persecution, prosecution by the Justice Department. I mean, it speaks volumes of Trump that in spite of all, I think probably in the long run, that in spite of all of his promises to put Hillary Clinton and her Confederates in jail if he got into office, that never actually happened.
She never got locked up. Huh?
Yeah. And so I mean, this goes to show, but no sooner the Democrats take control again than they do precisely what—
They're really locking them up.
Well, I mean, you know, a successive of Republican and indeed Democratic administrations prior to them have never done. This is, as with so many things that have happened in the last few years, this is virgin territory. That's probably too positive sounding a word. I mean, this is dangerous new territory that we've never seen before. It's very reminiscent of the way most other so-called democratic countries conduct their sordid political affairs. Namely, the party that's in power is the one that's out of jail. And the ones that are in jail are the ones that had the misfortune of being upended in the most recent elections by fair means and or foul, usually foul. I mean, I've something of a maven for, you know, foreign politics in countries like India and Malaysia and other countries that I've been to. And that's how they all work. They're all ballyhooed as, you know, fledgling democracies. But in point of fact, this is how it always works. You know, the moment you get into power, that ipso facto becomes license to jail all of your opponents to make sure they can't make trouble for you while you're in power. And again, I think I've mentioned this in the show before, but I remember when I spent time in South India doing my PhD research.
Yeah, you mentioned
particular
that.
Yeah, it was amusing. There were these two individuals back in the 90s. This was a while ago, but they were the two power people. And they kept trading places. Every couple of years, they'd have elections, and one of them would go to power. And the first thing he or she, one was a he and one was a she. So he or she, the first thing he or she would do upon assuming power was to jail the other one.
Yeah.
And then they would wait in jail for a couple of years and issue these indignant statements. And their supporters would riot and demonstrate. And to no avail, the police would come out with their lathis and beat them into submission. And this charade would carry on for a period of 2 years or four. And then the elections would come again, and almost inevitably, because of the outrages perpetrated against the one group, that aggrieved group would then be voted back into power, and they would immediately do the same thing to their opponent.
Let me
back and forth. So, yeah, this, for me at least, is a familiar scenario. Yeah.
I want to put two things out there. First of all, there was a commentator who brought up the point that Navarro was actually the mastermind, or at least one of the brains behind the anti-China tariffs, and so the idea is that if Trump gets back into office, we got to make sure this guy doesn't get back in. But also, what you're saying may actually judicially apply if Trump does get back in the House, because I think there is reason to believe we have bona fide criminals in the White House, in this cabinet now. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I mean, maybe another way of looking at this, for those of us who are old enough to still appreciate Westerns, I mean, one of the standard themes of the Western is the wicked, corrupt sheriff who allies with the evil cattle baron and surrounds himself with gunsels and wreaks havoc and intimidates all the local populace until, you know, the good guy, usually John Wayne or Gary Cooper or somebody like that, rides into town, cleans things up, and everything's right. But the idea was that, and things like this did in fact happen in the Wild West, and even within the, you know, in the America, in South and so forth, there were plenty of cases of local justice going awry. Even today, you know, local police and even sheriffs, unfortunately, become corrupt and all this kind of thing. And the notion is, well, but if it gets too bad, you know, the people can take care of it, or you can bring in state officials or federal officials can sort it out. Yeah. There's always a higher power. The idea that level of lawless corruption and, you know, could you know, this go thuggery up, could obtain at the national level
all the way to the top,
it was not to be thought of until fairly recently. But now we're seeing that same level of thuggishness. And the problem is, okay, who deals with it? Because we're seeing now the very Department of Justice perverting the law, you know, as into an instrument of plunder, as Bastiat once put it so eloquently, you know, and who's going to hold them to account? We're having problems with that. Because this is the federal government, it has,
de facto,
if not de jure, has arrogated so much illegitimate, unconstitutional power, you know, that it's able to apparently do this stuff with impunity. Now, we shall see. Obviously, we have elections coming up this year. They're crucial because beyond determining whether we get another 4 years of this atrocious, tyrannical regime or whether they get replaced, you know, by more sane people, the real issue is whether we're going to remain, at least retain some pretext of being a country of laws.
Yeah.
Okay? That's what's at stake here. And right now, we clearly aren't.
Yes. And we're going to keep an eye on that as the closer we get to elections. There's so many developments. So good point there. Up next, the National Park Service is being sued for its unconstitutional anti-cash policies.
Hey, America. How tired are you of mainstream corporate media's biased narratives and manipulated news? Their dishonesty and attempts to influence this generation have been exposed, put on display for anyone who's even half paying attention. But the New American Magazine has been an honest source of news and commentary for over 50 years. This is your opportunity to receive the stalwart of principled journalism at a deep discount. Picture a beautifully published magazine arriving at your doorstep twice a month, packed with insightful stories written with integrity. It's also available digitally on the New American's mobile app. Get up to speed with intelligent coverage from a freedom perspective. Right now, for a limited time, the New American is available to radio listeners at a 25% discount on a new subscription. Visit thenewamerican.com/radio25 and receive 25% off. Subscribe today at thenewamerican.com/radio25.
If we aren't self-reliant, we aren't free. And if we can't take care of ourselves without the so-called help of government, how much liberty do we really have? That's why the New American Magazine has released a special collector's edition bookazine on this very important topic. It's called Self-Reliance, Foundation of Freedom. America has a rich tradition as being the home of staunchly independent explorers, religious dissidents, and general malcontents who seek to live the way humans are intended to, free. It's time to get back to those roots, and living an independent life is key. In our latest special edition, we cover a number of self-reliance-related topics, including the self-sufficiency of the Founding Fathers, self-reliance lessons from COVID, preparing for a worst-case scenario, financial independence, and the importance of community, among many other important topics. The writers are experts in their fields, and they provide a handy guide to get you started. So go to thenewamerican.com/shop and order your copy. Heck, get two. One for you, another for someone you care about. But even better, for $5 more, you can get our entire collector's edition packet, which in addition to the one on self-reliance, includes Trump World and The Great Reset. Again, visit thenewamerican.com/shop, or you can even order by phone at 920-749-3780 Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 p.m. Central Time. That's 920-749-3780. A small group of people are suing the National Park Service for its anti-cash policy. Last year, a Georgia woman named Elizabeth Dosberg was told that she couldn't use legal tender to get into a national park in the Peach State. According to the lawsuit, she was informed in writing that she wouldn't be admitted to Fort Pulaski National Historic Site if she tried to use cash. She was told this was part of a change that went into effect in 2020. She was advised to use the cash and buy a gift card and pay that way. Toby Stover of New York, another plaintiff, went to Hyde Park in New York on January 26, only to have her cash refused. And Esther Vanderwerf of California learned she couldn't get into Tonto National Monument, Saguaro National Park, and Oregon Pipe National Monument with cash. Children's Health Defense is financially supporting the lawsuit. Kim Rosenberg, an attorney with CHD, said, "By forcing people to use credit cards or digital wallets under the guise of convenience, the National Park Service becomes a player in the surveillance state, undermining park visitors' privacy rights." All right, Steve. So we had another story yesterday showing how the FBI had been colluding with banks to surveil essentially anyone who was in the Washington, D.C. area between certain dates. And the investigatory committee had reason to believe the surveillance was even broader. And they're supposed to take, I mean, this lawsuit is citing obviously the Constitution that they're supposed to take legal tender. I know this is a pet peeve of yours because you and I talk about it sometimes, about these places that don't accept cash.
Well, there are actually several layers to this. So let's start with the whole concept of legal tender. You'll see on your a $20 bill, there's a phrase, this money is what is it, public tender for all debt, or legal tender for all debts, public and private.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the phrase that's used. Legal tender laws themselves are fundamentally unjust because they were enacted in the wake of the Roosevelt administration's confiscation of all private gold, other than jewelry, in the 1930s. Okay, it made it illegal to own gold coins, gold ingots, gold bars, and things of this nature. And so people were required to turn it in, which in return for which they received fiat paper money.
Yeah.
And to buttress that, the government passed what we now call legal tender laws, meaning that you cannot legally say, well, that's just worthless paper. I want you to pay in gold and silver or some other unspecified commodity instead. You're required by law to accept paper money and also coinage as legal tender. Okay, so the law, the spirit of the legal tender law is unjust from the outset because it basically seeks to compel people to accept this new unconstitutional and fundamentally dangerous regime, permanent regime of fiat money, which is inflationary. We don't have time to get into that today. But we've talked about it before. We will doubtless talk about it in the future. That's where legal tender laws are unjust. But leaving that aside, okay?
So now they become more unjust. I mean, the whole thing is based on the foundation.
Well, sure. And this is not a new thing either. I mean, there have been companies allowed to violate legal tender laws for some time. For example, car rental companies. If you rent a car, you can't pay for it with a check or cash or even a debit card. You must use a credit card. Okay, and this is true. And there's as always, there's a rationale. Oh, well, you know, because we want to be protected, we have to charge a lot more and so forth and so on. The credit card gives us that guarantee in case you wreck the car or steal it. But the bottom line is they're being allowed selectively and preferentially to violate legal tender laws, something you and I can't do. You know, you and I can't go and let's say I have a tractor I want to sell and tell, I don't want your paper money. You need to pay me in gold because I want gold now. Can't do that. If I try to do that,
are you sure?
Because
people sell stuff online, and they're like,
I only take
cash.
Well, that's different. No, cash is legal tender. I'm talking about requiring something other than cash. Okay, so what the government, in other words, saying, you know, well, I'm not going to take your cash. You can only pay with a credit card. That's violating legal tender because it says right on every piece of paper money that this is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
Yeah. Okay.
And yet, apparently, it no longer is. And so now that. You know, that's that penumbra slowly of exceptionalism is being expanded to include government agencies.
Notice how this took effect in 2020 when a lot of other changes took effect.
Right. So, I mean, what's happening now is that the government is realizing that old-fashioned cash, offensive though it is, because it is inflationary, is still not the ultimate, you know, what they want to accomplish. What they want to accomplish is a way of tracking every single cent that you spend. And obviously, even paper money, vicious though it is, inflationary though it is,
they can't track it.
Yeah, you can't track it, which is why, obviously, criminals still like paper money. You know, although we've all seen movies where the drug traffickers have bales and bales and bales, you know, Breaking Bad and this kind of thing. Yeah. You know,
they have all the cash. They walk around with the wads.
Oh yeah. This has become symbolic of the lawless criminal life is being able to roll out the Benjamins, you know, and so to speak. But
I want to walk around
I mean, probably addressing the fact that those Benjamins are themselves inflationary and probably all those gang lords would prefer to be able to amass gold and silver.
Yeah.
You know,
beside
the point. But so we're what I'm saying, I guess, is that we're looking at choosing the lesser of two evils. Okay, and the lesser of two evils right now is most decidedly retaining the option of paying in cash, even if it's a badly debased inflationary currency that we hope someday to restore to some semblance of fiscal sanity by reinstating the gold standard, the bimetallic standard that's enjoined in the Constitution.
Yeah, that's what we need to bring back.
We're a long ways from that. But obviously, you know, allowing our government to violate legal tender laws and get rid of and moving toward this goal of a cashless society that we hear about, and we've been hearing about, again, this has been around for some time, 20, 30 years, this ultimate goal of a cashless society. That is decidedly a step in the wrong direction.
So we need to go back. We need to have some sort of campaign to push for cash. Now, I did read that report by the Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of Government, and it mentioned in there how government, even though it is tracking even cash by way of when people pull a conspicuous or a suspicious amount of cash, you know, if it's past this point or whatever, you know, if it's more that exceeds a certain amount, they start raising the alarm, the flag. So they're already beginning to do that. But like you said, it's really important that we preserve cash. So then we can go to the next step, right? To go back to bimetallics, because what we have less ground then, or less, we've lost more position if we lose cash to go back to bimetallics, which I think we still maintain is probably the best way.
Well, and it's becoming more and more dangerous all the time, because the reality is that the so-called money supply most of the money supply now is not in cash at all, even in the vaults of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Some would argue money's banks. Not even real now.
Well, you know, I mean, most of the money that exists, the money supply M1, M2, is primarily created by computer entry.
Yeah.
It never even gets instantiated as cash. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So never gets printed or
right,
anything.
Or it never gets printed at all. So, I mean, the whole term, you know, well, the Fed has been printing money like crazy. Well, okay, metaphorically speaking, and once upon a time, that was true when the preponderance of U.S. money was at least in cash. That is no longer the case. And we are definitely moving farther and farther away. There's no question that being able to pay virtually is a convenience.
Yeah.
Okay. But even in the days of the gold standard, it was possible to do that. You know, because there was paper money, but it represented actual claims on real assets. And I think that digital money could be the same. You know, computer entries could be the same. There's nothing stopping it from being tethered to gold and silver.
Thanks, Steve. After this, are the Irish and Portuguese done with socialism and wokeism?
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of the New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, END20.
For more news and in-depth analysis from the New American Magazine, the kind that you will not get anywhere else, make sure you have a subscription to our twice monthly print edition of the magazine. No other magazine has been as accurate and for as long about where policy and culture were heading than The New American. You can subscribe online at thenewamerican.com. Just hit the magazine tab on top and then on the drop-down, hit the subscribe button. Or if you prefer, you can call for a subscription. Call 1-800-727-8783 Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. That's 800-727-8783. The right is still on a roll in Europe. This time in Ireland and Portugal. On Friday, Irish citizens voted on whether to change how their 1937 constitution refers to women and families. There were two proposed amendments that targeted language which defines the family and the need for government to protect it. One of the amendments aimed to broaden the definition of family from being based on marriage to being based on durable relationships, which would include cohabiting and unmarried couples in the family category. The other aimed to get rid of a clause that refers to a mother's duties in the home, which, of course, is offensive to the left. Nevertheless, the Irish defeated the amendments resoundingly by a 70% majority. This then prompted the usual whiny warnings from the radical left about the menace of backwards conservative moral values, all those pesky tried and true values. For the record, here is the text that's triggering the left. The state recognizes the family as the natural primary and fundamental unit group of society and as a moral institution possessing inalienable and imprescriptible rights antecedent and superior to all positive law. The state therefore guarantees to protect the family in its constitution and authority as the necessary basis of social order and as indispensable to the welfare of the nation and the state. In particular, the state recognizes that by her life within the home, a woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. The state pledges itself to guard with special care the institution of marriage on which the family is founded and to protect it against attack. Pay attention, folks, because these exact values are under attack in all the Western world. Meanwhile, in Portugal, voters went to the polls on Sunday and delivered a major rebuke to the socialists who had been in charge of the country since 2015. Then a coalition of right-wing parties joined self-styled center-right social democrats and formed a new government. But especially interesting was the new right populist party called Chega, which means enough in Portuguese. Chega was founded just 5 years ago, but it's now attracting lots of young voters who are disillusioned with government corruption. The socialist government collapsed 2 months ago because of an influence-peddling scandal. Chega checks all the populist boxes. It's garnered approval from the likes of Trump and Brazil's Bolsonaro, and the media accuses it of extremism and misinformation. But there's already resistance brewing from the new center-right coalition called the Democratic Alliance, which is the Portuguese version of the American GOP. The Democratic Alliance is refusing to allow Chega a place at the table, this despite Chega now being Portugal's third largest political party. The problem is that Chega opposes Portugal's lax immigration policies and it's vowing to clean up political corruption. But the leader of the Democratic Alliance has already ruled out any alliance with Chega, and Portugal's largest newspaper, Expresso, has reported that Portuguese President Marcelo de Souza will do anything to keep Chega from being a part of the new government. Well, Steve, this seems to happen a lot in Europe. I think the same thing is happening with the ADF out in Germany. They're refusing to acknowledge them, too.
And in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. So how is that democratic, or, you know, that's their version of a liberty-oriented society?
Well, this is one of the great ironies of modernity, right, is that those who profess to be the Democrats always show themselves to be the least democratic whenever someone opposes their agenda. We're seeing that happen right here in the United States, of course, but it's also in the United States. Oh, we're democratic, but these people are beyond the pale. Mm. You know, they don't really express the will of rational thinking human beings, so we're going to exclude them.
So long as you do and think the way we want.
Yeah, the problem in Portugal is that they are not going to be able to form a government without the complaisance of Chega, without Chega participating. They don't have a sufficient majority. They're hoping to cut a corrupt bargain with the socialists, who are out of power, but only barely if the Chega results are excluded. So they really won't be able to do. And I'm not sure. I mean, these parliamentary systems work a little differently than ours. And so having a crucial majoritarian coalition is usually the key. Although Portugal has had a couple of minoritarian governments in the past, it can be done. It's not easy. And you know, I mean, Portugal. We don't tend to think about Portugal. Once Portugal, of course, was once a global power. It was the country that, with the thanks to the innovations of, you know, Prince Henry the Navigator, really ushered in the era of European exploration.
Well, it was an empire there for three seconds, wasn't it?
Well, they did. I mean, they of course, aside from Brazil, which is the big prize in Latin America, they also had four different countries in Africa that are Portuguese speaking, and a few outposts in Asia, Macau and South China, and couple places in India. So yeah, Portugal was a very significant world power for a long time. It's a beautiful country. I've been there. It's become lately quite a haven of repose for Americans, who particularly retirees and who want to expatriate because of favorable laws. And that, ironically, is one of the things that has pushed Chega to prominence. It's only been around since 2019.
The American influence?
The lax immigration laws. It's very easy to immigrate right now. This may change in the near future, but it's very easy right now if you are sick and tired of paying taxes in the United States and the cost of living here and so forth. A large number of Americans are saying, well, heck, I'm going to move abroad to Ecuador, Costa Rica, and Portugal is one of the top destinations. It has been for a number of years because it's very easy to get a residence visa. The cost of living is very low and the healthcare system is relatively cheap. And all of these things, you know, the Portuguese are now saying the same thing we're saying vis-a-vis the unrestrained immigration or southern border. Wait a minute. Portugal should be for Portuguese, not for all these foreigners,
including us.
You know, that's part of the irony here.
Yeah. I mean, all of Europe is waking up, and hopefully the Overton window, as they call it, when it comes to discussing immigration is changed at some point, and we start to see that this is an attack on civilization. Why is it okay to attack one part of civilization, that being Western civilization, but it's not okay to do so with others? I mean, Western civilization built the world that we're in, and it seems like there is a coordinated effort to destroy it. And that's part of it.
Well, because the idea is that we'll replace it with something even better, which is a global civilization.
How is that evident? So, Where is that coming from?
I just want to say, regarding Portugal, though, one other point. I mean, again, although it is not a country that we think of as a first-tier country, a European power, their former president, Antonio Guterres, of course, is now the Secretary General of the United Nations. He's proving to be very influential. He's the guy. He's the moving power behind this upcoming conference that intends to be a profound rewrite of the entire United Nations Charter later this summer, this year in New York City in September. And hopefully we'll have some people be able to cover that event.
Yeah.
And so but Guterres was not only the president of Portugal, he also was the leader of the Socialist Party there and the president of the Socialist International. So he may come from a small country that's relatively poor, but you know, the Portuguese socialism is definitely a thing on the international scene, and Guterres' career is evidence of that. So for these elections to push the socialists themselves aside is, I think, a significant event.
It
and
is,
we hope
yeah.
a bellwether of better things to come, just for Portugal, but for all of Europe and the larger West.
I got to be honest. I thought that perhaps Europe is beyond saving, but we're seeing this resurgence. I mean, Ireland changed a lot in the last few generations, but it's nice to see. I mean, 70%, that's good, you know, but is it really indicative of as positive a trend as we may be portraying it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just speaking in generalities, we're seeing a lot of positive things happening in Europe, but outside of Hungary, so far it's still a trend. It hasn't actually translated into concrete action, except maybe Italy.
Good point.
Okay, so Meloni's Italy may be a point. But I think right now what's happening in Argentina and even here in the United States with the resurgent MAGA movement is probably more indicative of what may be coming. I see more promise for those movements because they're more comprehensive. They've actually achieved real electoral success.
Yes.
We'll see. I think the jury is still out on Western Europe. It is so captive to the agenda of the internationalists and has been
for a long time.
This predates the creation of the European Union. It goes all the way back to the early 18th century, at least, that the Europeans have been trying to figure out some sort of schema for international government along socialist lines. This is not a new thing.
Yes. Well, it's encouraging nonetheless. Let's hope they can take it to practicality there. John Birch Society Field Coordinator Rhonda Miller joins us next to discuss how Birchers helped defeat a recent ConCon effort in Indiana.
Self-reliance. It's not a phrase we hear much in our culture these days. It might conjure up images of pioneers, the West, rifles, strapping men, and strong women. But what does it mean for us in today's world? The New American Magazine has just released its latest collector's edition, Self-Reliance, Foundation of Freedom. In it, the New American authors outline the necessity of self-reliance for a free people, tips for self-reliant living, and the importance of not giving up hope. This unique edition includes articles on the self-sufficiency of the founders, preparing for a worst-case scenario, firearms, financial self-reliance, the importance of community, and many other topics by expert writers. Now, for a limited time, the New American is offering a bundle of three collector's editions, Self-Reliance, The Great Reset, and Trump World, for just $19.95. A great stocking stuffer, available at shopjbs.org. Visit shopjbs.org today.
I recently spoke to John Birch Society Coordinator Rhonda Miller about her latest ConCon victory out in Indiana. Check it out. Joining me is Rhonda Miller, the JBS coordinator out of Indiana, and we're going to discuss about how Birchers, with the help of some allies, I assume, defeated the calls for an Article 5 convention in the Hoosier State. Hey, Rhonda.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to hear this. We've done pretty well, and I don't want to start patting ourselves on the back too soon because we kicked butt last year, and we're hoping to keep that streak alive. But here we have another instance in a place that's otherwise or is considered pretty conservative, but it's some of that is misleading. And this call for an Article 5 convention, I wouldn't necessarily say that's part of it, but this is something we truly oppose for a number of reasons. And our viewers and our listeners and JBS members know a lot of those reasons. But I would say when you summarize them all, we oppose an Article 5 convention because you never know what's going to come out of that. This is totally the wrong environment to do anything close to opening the Constitution. And furthermore, we kind of already have a pretty decent Constitution, and we don't really, what we need is to educate, not open the Constitution and make changes on it. So those are our main arguments. But today we're going to talk about, this is a taking action segment, and we're going to talk about what you guys did down in Indiana. We're going to show them how it works, what organization by the John Birch Society looks like. So take it away.
Yeah, so when we got wind that HRJ3 had come out of the House, we weren't expecting it. And so when I found out about it, it was in the Judiciary Committee in the Senate.
Yeah.
And so we were able to rally a couple of our members, and we headed down to the State House. This resolution dealt with term limits for Congress. And so we were able to push back. And as I testified to the chairwoman in the committee, you know, I referred to them. I told them, I said, you know what? We already have a constitution, and you already have the ability as a legislature to nullify what the federal government is doing, is rein those powers in at the state level. Because she kept saying, well, we have a right, we have a duty to call for this convention. And I said, well, you already have the powers to rein in the federal government. Why aren't you using those? And it got a little intense between the exchange. But before the committee actually heard testimony, there was a couple of senators, Senator Freeman on the committee and then Senator Buck. They actually pushed back on the author of the bill from the House. And he'd only been there for 2 years. He was a fairly new legislator they had worked with to bring this resolution forward. And so they had questioned him, why are you wanting U.S. term limits? I mean, how long do you think a congressman or a senator should serve? And he couldn't give them any numbers because he didn't have any, right?
Yeah.
And so they were definitely pushing back. There were three Republicans actually that pushed back, and all of the Democrats. It was interesting because when I got done testifying, I went into the hallway to see one, talk to one of the other senators who had come down to see me. And one of the Democrats from the committee actually came out, and he's an older man, and I've never had a conversation with him before, but he came out and he put his hand on my shoulder and he says, Rhonda, I have to tell you, he goes, based on what you just said, he said, and what Senator Freeman and Senator Buck said, he goes, I can no longer support this. He goes, I just want to thank you for coming down here and stating this. So it was kind of astonishing to think that I was able to flip one senator that would have was wavering. And
well, it's not, because I've heard that same story over and over. When I was in Texas, I talked to a lot of COS or Convention of States supporters who support an Article 5 convention, and ex-supporters too. Our tables were like three tables apart. You know, we had Gun Owners of America between us and like maybe one other one. So, and you know, they're like, I supported too an Article 5 convention. And then I heard the arguments from the John Birch Society, and it just made so much sense. And I think what you're describing is a lot of rational people will hear this and it's like, gosh, well, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's like, I term limits, that's the one, that's, they go with two, one of two or both, term limits and balanced budget amendments, right? Mm-hmm. And so good to hear that. I mean, term limits is one of those things. It's like, I tell people too, it's like, well, we kind of already have term limits. Why not get rid of them? And then what do you hear afterwards? It's like, oh, well, you know, people are going to keep voting in the rhinos. It's like, well, so how are they going to change then? You know, it's like they'll vote the next block of rhinos. But what's worse, and I think this is where it would really hurt us, is it's harder to get constitutionalists in, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So those term limits, I imagine, would hurt us.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing I mentioned too, though, was you know, if we had free and fair elections.
Oh yeah, that would be nice.
The election process would take care of, if you're not happy with who's representing you, you have the right to vote them out of office, right? But we have to have free and fair elections in order to make that happen. So I did bring that into the conversation as well. And so it was interesting because we were able to push it back. Now, in 2016, we did pass a resolution that called for a balanced budget resolution.
We being in Indiana.
Yeah, in Indiana. So that is something we'll have to work on trying to repeal that going forward. But at least at this point, we were able to stop the U.S. term limits.
So were there other Birchers there? Did they testify? I mean, I haven't seen all the hearings, but I've seen some, and some have been a little more organized than others, and there were more, and it took more power to shut it down. But were there other Birchers who testified as to why this would cause a problem and it's going to cause more problems than whatever it's going to fix?
Yeah, there was one other Birch member we had at the last minute been able to rally to go down to the State House with us. And so there were only three people that testified, two of us against, and then the man from the U.S. term limits.
Oh, okay.
So we had stirred up enough animosity towards it when we started that by the time he was done at the end, there were too many that were like, there's too many unanswered questions. He wasn't answering their questions to their satisfaction. So actually, there were only three, but there were two of us against it. So
yeah. And it was pretty, I'd imagine, it's always scary when it gets past one of the chambers. Usually when you want to kill it in committee, first chamber, before ever going, because obviously the further it goes, your chances start to dwindle down a little bit. But you had mentioned the balanced budget. So does that mean that Indiana is a con state? I don't even know. Is it one that has applied? It's one of the 21 or 23?
As far as I can recall, yes.
So we need a rescission in Indiana, huh?
Yes, yes, we do. And so that's something that we'll start working on in the state of Indiana to make that happen. So
what are you guys going to do? Are you guys going to start working with the legislators, start educating the public?
Yeah, we'll have to start there because an educated populace, right, will put pressure on the legislatures. And then in educating the legislators about what this really could cause in the long term. So hopefully we did enough laying the groundwork on these U.S. term limits resolution that we can build on that momentum and help them understand this is not something we want. But the other thing I referred to in my testimony was the tremendous videos that the John Birch Society has put out, helping expose the con and the efforts to combat what they're calling for. So, in fact, I referred to the legislators and said, I encourage you to go watch those videos because they're very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. We had, we made quite a few. And we've also, I think the most recent one we made was included legislators from various states, including, I think, Iowa, North Dakota, and whatnot. But those are more kind of like highlighting the kind of the chicanery, the skullduggery of the main organization pushing for this, which, of course, is Convention of States. And we don't want to turn this into a segment against Convention of States. But I would think that right now they're probably the ones who are pushing this the most. But they haven't done too well, even though we are so outgunned in when it comes to resources. When it comes to, I mean, they go around and they, I guess we are going to turn this at the end against the outside. You know, it's like they spend lots of money. They have these high profile endorsers, but not Glenn Beck anymore, you know. and then, you know, they wine and dine these legislators. Are you aware? Did they do any of that? Were they even in Indiana or have they given up? What are they up to these days?
No, there's a push. There's a con group, Convention of States group in Indiana.
Yeah.
And they've had rallies down to State House, including this year. Yeah. And so I think they have rallied their troops. But in the end, we were able to stop this, at least, effort. So are we heading towards
a bigger battle in the next session? Is that where this is going?
Yeah, I think so, because we've got our work cut out for us and we know that they're getting so close to what they want. So we've got to stop their momentum.
Yeah, they do have to be stopped, like I said. But when I was patting myself on the back a couple minutes earlier, we managed to stop all of their efforts last year. And I believe there are quite a few rescission efforts. Well, Rhonda, thank you so much. Thank you for what you do as a coordinator out there. Keep up the good work. And anyone listening and watching, if you want to join Rhonda, there you can go to jbs.org and I believe is Take Action, and you can contact your coordinator. You put your zip code in there and they'll connect you to the right coordinator. So get involved, folks. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to the American Daily. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news, and we'll see you tomorrow.